was raised by his grandparents. His background includes a strong emphasis on education as the key to a better life. And he attended rigorous Catholic schools where he excelled. After spending a year at the Immaculate Conception Seminary in Conception Junction, Missouri, Clarence transferred to Holy Cross College in Worcester, where he supported himself through loans and scholarships and jobs, and graduated with honors in 1971. After graduation from Yale Law School, he worked for then-Missouri Attorney General John Danforth and spent 2.5 years litigating cases of all descriptions. In 1977, Judge Thomas practiced law in the private sector, and in 1979, he rejoined Senator Danforth as a legislative assistant in the U.S. Senate. In 1981, President Reagan appointed him Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Department of Education. From 1982 to 1990, he served as President Reagan's chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And I appointed him to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in 1990. I have followed this man's career for some time, and he has excelled in everything that he has attempted. He is a delightful and warm, intelligent person who has great empathy and a wonderful sense of humor. He's also a fiercely independent thinker with an excellent legal mind who believes passionately in equal opportunity for all Americans. He will approach the cases that come before the court with a commitment to deciding them fairly as the facts and the law require. Judge Thomas's life is a model for all Americans, and he's earned the right to sit on this nation's highest court. And I am very proud indeed to nominate him for this position, and I trust that the Senate will confirm this able man promptly. And now, Judge Thomas, if you'd like to say a few words, and then what we'll do is questions for either of us, and then if you finish those, then I'll be glad to stay and take questions on a wide array of subjects.
Thank you, sir. You're
welcome, and I'm just so pleased you came up. All yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm honored and humbled by your nomination of me to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. As a child, I could not dare dream that I would ever see the Supreme Court, not to mention be nominated to it. Indeed, my most vivid childhood memory of the Supreme Court was the Impeach Earl Warren signs which lined Highway 17 near Savannah. I didn't quite understand who this Earl Warren fellow was, but I knew he was in some kind of trouble. I thank all of those who have helped me along the way and who've helped me to this point and this moment in my life, especially my grandparents who are... Especially my grandparents, my mother, and the nuns, all of whom were adamant that I grow up to make something of myself. I also thank my wonderful wife and my wonderful son. In my view, only in America could this have been possible. I look forward to the confirmation process and an opportunity to be of service once again to my country and to be an example to those who are where I was and to show them that indeed there is hope. Thank you again, Mr. President.
Now, either of us will take questions. As you can understand, Judge Thomas, the next important step for him is going up for confirmation. And as with every predecessor for the Supreme Court, I'm sure you'll understand if he won't take questions on specific issues or philosophy or things of that nature. But if you have any for him or for me about this appointment or matters relating to the court, I'd be glad to respond. I know he would. And then, as I say, it's been a while, and we want to go ahead and just have a general press conference on any other subjects that come to mind.
Mr. President, how will you answer concerns stemming from Judge Thomas's days as chairman of the EEOC that in that post he was somewhat insensitive to the concerns of the elderly and civil rights advocates, and that he didn't aggressively pursue their complaints?
Well, obviously that complaint, if it was even raised in his confirmation hearings for the second highest court in the land, were satisfactorily answered. It is my view that the complaints are unfounded, of course, but I doubt if anybody had strongly felt that, that he would have been confirmed for his present position.
Mr. President?
Yeah.
Last year you vetoed the civil rights bill saying it could lead to quotas. Today you made a nomination that could at least be seen as quota-based. How do you explain this apparent inconsistency?
I don't even see an appearance of inconsistency, because what I did was look for the best man. And Clarence Thomas's name was high on the list when the previous nominee went forth, Judge Souter, just Mr. Justice Souter now. And so I don't accept that at all. And the fact that he is black and a minority has nothing to do with this, in the sense that he is the best qualified at this time. And we had a very thorough screening process then. We had one now that we put into forward gear very fast, but we didn't have to start from square one. So Clarence Thomas, seasoned now by more experience on the bench, fits my description of the best man at the right time, or the best person at the right time, because other women were considered as well.
But do you see how it could be perceived?
No, I can't see it.
Was race a factor whatsoever, sir?
I don't see it at all. The fact that he's a minority, you heard his testimony to the kind of life he's had, and I think that speaks eloquently for itself. But I kept my word to the American people and to the Senate by picking the best man for the job on the merits. And the fact he's minority, so much the better. But that is not the factor, and I would strongly resent any charge that might be forthcoming on quotas when it relates to appointing the best man to the court. That's the kind of thing I stand for, not opposed to.
Just so I can ask the question, was race a factor whatsoever, though, sir?
Well, I tried to answer it just then as best I could. Nice try for the second go-round. Susan?
If I could follow up, I mean, there are many people who felt that, in fact, that was a plus. Not that it was a factor or a quota, but that, in fact, since the court represents all the people, there ought to be a minority member. Did you at all feel that way?
But I don't feel there's a quota. I don't feel that I had to appoint, nominate a black American at this time for the court. I express my respect for the ground that Mr. Justice Marshall plowed, but I don't feel there should be a black seat on the court or an ethnic seat on the court, if that's what your question is. I would reiterate, I think he's the best man, and if credit accrues to him for coming up through a tough life as a minority in this country, so much the better. So much the better. I love what he said at the end. It proves you can do it. Get the job done. And so if that does nothing but enhance the court, in my view, but I just really want you to know we looked at this list with an idea of really finding the best, and I think that's what we did. Yeah, Charles?
I wonder if I could ask a question of Judge Thomas, Mr. President. You made reference, sir, to Chief Justice Warren, the Warren Court, known as a liberal court, but one that advanced a lot of things in the way of civil rights and on behalf of minorities. How do you feel about that court vis-a-vis the very conservative court that you seem to be joining?
Well, I think that many of the questions that I will be asked during my confirmation process will perhaps bring that comparison out, and I think out of respect for that process, I'll have to refrain from making that sort of comparison at this point.
Not even a personal reflection, sir, on what the Warren Court did for minorities?
Not even a personal reflection.
Judge, a question for you. What do you say to critics who say the only reason you're being picked is because you're black?
I think a lot worse things have been said. I disagree with that, but I'll have to live with it.
You referring to the press? How about that for a name?
Well, I also say I didn't make this election.
President, civil rights groups, in particular Ben Hooks, have signaled that you're in for the mother of all confirmations hearings if you nominated Judge Thomas. What do you have to say about that?
Well, one, I find that very surprising from a man that's as fair as Ben Hooks. So, and I learned something in this job, as some of the others that cover us regularly here understand, and that is that I don't like to comment on a statement attributed to somebody until I've actually read it. But I think when you go back and look at the support that Judge Thomas had for the bench that he now serves on, that in itself will take care of any arguments that someone... I just don't want to feel that Ben Hooks said that. I know him, I respect him, and I don't think that... that he would say that about Judge Thomas. I'll be honest with you.
At his confirmation hearings before, it was said that if he was accepted to the bench, but if you brought him back to the Supreme Court, that they didn't feel that he would be ready for that at the time.
Well, he isn't the Attorney General, nor the General Counsel to the President, nor the Chief of Staff, nor those of us who screened this nomination. It is our judgment he will. I think you're going to find many senators that disagree with the fact he's not ready. Look, I'm not suggesting there'll be no opposition, but you put it on quite a personal one with Ben, and I just can't believe he would make a statement like that. I've differed with him on a lot of things and agreed with him on many, but I simply do not want to accept that until I see it. I'm not questioning your motives or challenging your authenticity of the statement, but please let me just defer until I take a look at it.
Mr. President?
Yo.
Mr. President? When you selected Judge Souter, your aides very clearly put out the word that Edith Jones of Houston was the runner-up and likely would be the nominee if another vacancy came up. What happened to change the equation?
Well, she's a very able justice, a judge. She was given consideration then and now, and I just felt that Judge Thomas, with his seasoning now, is best prepared to serve. It was that. It was not a demeaning or putting down of anybody else, because there were some very good names brought to my attention. And I might say, this just happened last week, and some will be saying, well, was the screening process thorough? And the point I want to make is that I have met several times since Judge Souter's sending to the bench to discuss what would happen if a Supreme Court justice stepped down, with no one particularly in mind, but just to be ready. So consideration was given to a wide array of candidates, but we'd already done a lot of homework. But you ask about Edith, who comes from my hometown, and I have nothing but high regard and high esteem for her. But I decided, on the advice of people that I trust, that this is the way to go.
President, the appointments made by President Reagan and you have put the court on a conservative road. Is that what you would like to see for the next 10 or 15 years, to reverse some of the more liberal rulings in the past 20 years?
Look, I don't know how Judge Thomas, when he becomes Mr. Justice Thomas, will come down on every issue. And indeed, I didn't discuss specific issues with him. I didn't discuss them with Judge Souter before he became Mr. Justice Souter. But I did look at this. Would he faithfully interpret the Constitution and avoid the tendency to legislate from the bench? And that's a broad consideration, but that was certainly in his favor, in my view. And I don't know whether he'll agree with positions that our administration takes, or overthrow decisions, or change positions that we think are right, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that he faithfully interpret the Constitution, and I am 100% convinced that that's exactly what he'll do. So we're not trying to put a philosophical balance on this court. We're not trying to philosophically affect it. I want, and I've said this long ago, long before I became president, that the main consideration, in addition to excellence and qualification, is this concept of interpreting the Constitution and not legislating from the federal bench.
Mr. President,
President,
yeah, Mr. Massey, funny end here. Sir?
In the last several weeks, you and your White House counsel have had to act to tighten restrictions on travel of your subordinates. During this period of time, has Governor Sununu come to you at all and expressed any apology for any embarrassment that this might have caused you?
John, I'll take your question in one sec, but if we done the Supreme Court questions, because I don't want to get Clarence Thomas on the eve of his hearings caught up in a lot of domestic questions of one kind or another, including this one, which I'll be glad to respond to. But if you let me come back to you as soon as I ask him to go into the cool office that's behind us. But if there's any couple more on this, and then we'll move on to Mr. Mashick. Yeah.
Can I ask Judge Thomas this about quotas?
Again, I give you a similar answer. And when I was in a policy-making role, I said what I had to say about quotas. As a judge, I have not had an opportunity to rule on that issue. But to the extent that I have any additional comments, I think, again, out of respect for the advise and consent process, I'll have to leave it for that moment.
Does that also apply to questions involving whether or not there's a constitutional right to privacy?
Yes.
I have another question for the President. Did your list of possible candidates include anyone with known pro-choice views or any candidate whose views on abortion you were unsure of?
Probably. Because I don't know. I didn't ask about that.
There was a lot of talk about the possibility of an Hispanic being named. And
yes.
Judge Garza was interviewed.
He was.
Can you tell us what your thinking on that was? Why did you turn to Clarence Thomas instead of an Hispanic?
Well, I think experience in government, experience on the higher court, figured into this. But listen, that should not degrade Judge Garza at all. The man is a very well-qualified individual. Indeed, he flew up and had a conversation with Boyden Gray and with the Attorney General. And I just had to make a very tough call, and I did it. But he's a good man. Yes.
Mr. President, when did you make this decision in your own mind, and when did you call Judge Thomas to...
Well, I called him yesterday and told him I was getting very, very close in keeping the faith with those who were at the golf course. I called him after I came back from the golf course. But, and then I closed the deal today. I have one or two points that I wanted to make to him to see that he felt comfortable with them. I wanted to be sure that... He knew from me that there was no litmus test involved. I told him, if it's not violating a privacy, that he ought to do like the umpire. Call him as you see him. And I'm satisfied he will. But I guess I could say the final decision was made sitting in our living room, but it was pretty well established when I talked to him yesterday afternoon that that's what I wanted.
Did you know any other candidates?
No, I did not.
Do you feel as though this appointment will have any effect on your ability to get a civil rights bill through the Congress?
I don't think it has anything to do with it at all.
Do you anticipate any problems in the confirmation hearing?
Nope. Not if everyone's as fair as I think there will be. I think that there will be questions raised. I would hope there would not be political considerations. But look, you've seen confirmation hearings before, and you know that there's different people come in with a wide array of different questions, many of them philosophical. But I'm satisfied that this man will pass muster. Got it? Yeah. All right. I don't want to get you messed up in domestic politics here, Judge. So good luck, and I'll see you in a few minutes. May I duly note that that's the first press conference my family has attended and the first one at which there's been any applause. I hope this will continue. John.
Well, the question is, sir, is over the last several weeks that you and the White House counsel acting together have been forced to tighten the restrictions on travel regarding your subordinates. Has Governor Sununu come to you during any of this time and apologized to you for any embarrassment this may have caused?
Yes. He's told me right from the heart that he would regret it very much, any controversy and anything that this may have done to diminish the ethical standards of this presidency. And I told him, look, I understand this. He went into the staff and with essentially the same message. He said it publicly and very candidly, no laws having been violated. I think we ought to move on to something more important. And in this instance, it gives me a chance to express my full confidence in him as we work some very complicated issues through the Congress. I respect him. I value his advice and counsel. And I'm hoping that this matter is laid to rest. I think John said, if mistakes were made, I made them. And what more can a man be asked to say? And so I'd like to see this matter laid to rest.
At the very outset of your administration, you cautioned against even the appearance of impropriety, which you said this brought into...
That's why I think he came in and we had a good heart-to-heart talk, more than one about it. I'll be very honest with you, my heart aches for his family because they've been through a lot on some of the stories unrelated to this, kind of a what I refer to as a piling-on syndrome. So I'm glad this matter came up because I'd like to try to clear the air, get it behind us, and move on. But he's done the right things in terms of expressing his own personal feelings to me and to our staff and to others. And I made a mistake once. Let's see. It was back in 1970-something, rather. I can't remember exactly. Yeah.
Mr. President, what's the point of having meeting President Gorbachev at the G7 summit if all you're apparently willing to offer is moral support and technical advice, which are things that have been offered before?
You mean his coming to the summit? Well, I think it's quite important now that ground rules are getting worked out, that he come and present his case for reform to the G7. And I feel comfortable with what's been worked out by Prime Minister John Major and Mr. Gorbachev. I look forward to having a one-on-one with President Gorbachev there. And we got a lot to talk about, a lot of things that aren't related to the arms control agenda. And then I think there's going to be a bigger meeting with all seven that night after the formal part takes place. So I think it'll be a good chance to narrow down the differences, to see where we stand, Soviet Union and the Western Europe and Canada, United States and Japan. And so I'm looking forward to it. On our one-on-one talk, if that's what you're referring to, I don't think we'll have that much time. I think we got a couple of hours set aside. And Bob, couple of hours, but there's some issues that I need to talk about, global issues, and we got a lot of things that we look at identically, and we can go back and talk about those, such as the United Nations action against Iraq's aggression and things like that. But I think it's appropriate now. There was some, you know, you read a lot of stories that Gorbachev was coming there hat in hand asking for a big check. That was never his intention. I'm assured of that. And I don't think that did him a lot of good by even the speculation on that in some quarters, in the United States, for example. But I think the ground rules, or at least the broad parameters, are now set out, and I look forward to hearing what his plans are for a vigorous reform and the continuation of perestroika, glasnost being all but a given these days.
Presence in London raise expectations that are unlikely to be realized?
Well, yes, yeah, some might argue that, and some might say, well, his mere presence would indicate that if he didn't get something, that the meeting would be a failure. I don't view it that way. There is so much change taking place. The economic problems in the Soviet Union and elsewhere are so enormous that it's very important that we get as close together an agreement. But yes, I can see where some might suggest that, but I wouldn't view it that way. I would not view it, and I'll be resisting it if people say that. We've got an awful lot of consultation before concrete economic programs can be agreed to. Yeah.
On Iraq, there's news that the UN team went out looking again for that equipment and couldn't find it. Are you anticipating taking any action?
Well, we're anxious to see what this inspection, a two-person team, gets when they come back. But let me say this. Everybody Everyone knows that the man was cheating and lying. Everyone knows that he did that which the resolutions say not to do. And he should give unfettered access to these inspectors. He didn't do that. He surreptitiously moved the equipment. We've presented the evidence to certain parties. And all I'd say is he better get on with keeping his word. And he better get on with total, free, open inspection. And I said the other day, perhaps you missed it, but that we are not foreclosing nor putting on the table any options at this point. We have a lot of diplomacy to do. We want to be sure that world opinion is as strong as I'm convinced it will be, because this isn't a unilateral U.S. problem. This is a problem now of which the United Nations is seized, you see.
Have you talked to any of the leaders in the past day?
No, but others have been talking. I've not gone to the chiefs of state. I anticipate, maybe I indicated this the other day, that I will be doing that. This is a very high-level diplomatic decisions will be called on, or diplomatic initiatives will be called on, and decisions might follow. Rita, and then, yeah.
Mr. President, on Iraq, the other day, as we came to Kinabunk Court, you were in a sort of highly agitated mode, talking about hinting of a possible renewal of military action, although you also stressed diplomacy. But in the interim, has there been any news on this nuclear situation or anything that's caused you to think that maybe the situation is calming down?
No.
Or are you still saying that we have all options out
there? No, Rita, to be honest with you, I haven't seen anything that makes me think it's calming down. Not sure I would have used the word agitated, but certainly concerned. And what we got to have is evidence that full inspection on challenge will be granted, and I don't want to mislead you. I'm very concerned about this situation, and this is a fundamental part of what the United Nations resolutions is about. So. There's still a feeling out there, on my view anyway, and I'm sure it's true of the neighbors, that he has to make this right and satisfy us,
or
we'll figure out what else happens. Yeah.
Excuse me, did I cut a follow-up?
Just, is there still a possibility of renewed military action by the U.S. government?
Well, I just keep resisting saying what we will do or what we won't do. But you've seen speculation, and I'll just steer you that it's not all warrantless. But on the other hand, I'm not saying what it'll be recommended that I do as President of the United States. I'm very interested in getting the views of other world leaders, and the diplomacy leading up to that has already started. Yeah.
President, this fall, Israel intends to ask the United States to guarantee $10 billion in loans to build housing for Jewish refugees from the Soviet Union. Could you tell us how you feel about linking approval of these loan guarantees with some pledge from Israel that would freeze the building of new settlements in the occupied territories?
Well, I don't think it ought to be a quid pro quo. What I do think, and I've said this over and over again, that it is against U.S. policy for these settlements to be built. So I'll leave it right there. And avoid the linkage that you understandably ask about, but say that the best thing for Israel to do is to keep its commitment that was given at one point not to go in and build further settlements. It is counterproductive to the peace process. Now, having said that, I want to be fair. There are other things by other countries that are counterproductive to the peace process. I'd love to see direct talks between these countries, but we have not changed our position on sanctions, and we're not going to change, on settlements, and we're not going to change our position on settlements. So please, those in Israel, do what you can to see that that policy of settlement after settlement is not continued. It is counterproductive. And having heard the Secretary of State say that and seen what followed on, I will promptly add, as he has, that we want to be sure that others move forward in the peace process too. But it's not constructive to getting these parties to come together and work for a peace that I think the entire world wants and that all of them want. So we'll keep working it, but we're not giving one inch on the settlements question. Yeah.
President, the Corridor Commission is
made its recommendations, as you know, on base closing, subject to your review. Isn't it highly unlikely, though, that you would overrule any of those decisions, given the amount of time that the commission put into it?
Yes, with one exception. Yes, it is highly unlikely. But I will rely heavily on what Secretary Cheney tells me after he reviews the base closing recommendations, has a chance to talk to them with General Powell and the Joint Chiefs, because what I'm interested in, one, saving the money that we've said we'll save, two, being sure, and this comes first actually, that we have a proper structure from which to conduct military action that we might be called upon to conduct in the future. And so it would be unlikely, but I just would suggest, John, that I would like very much to sit down with the Secretary of Defense and say, Dick, are you happy with these? Do you see something that ought to be changed? And that's the way I'll conduct it. But I'm not going to go in there and override some decision on a political basis. These are tough calls. This commission, I am satisfied, is approaching it without politics in mind. I was in the Congress. I know the old rule about cutting it out, but cutting it in the other guy's district. And we simply cannot approach something as sensitive and as important to our national security as base closing in that manner. And so I will resist I won't participate in any political call, but I will. I do reserve the right, upon receipt of the commission's report, I think it comes directly to me, to discuss it with the Secretary of Defense after he's had an opportunity to talk to the chiefs about it. Yeah.
President, can you talk a bit about your mother and what she's taught you?
Well,
why you chose her birthday to announce your nominee?
Well, maybe it's fortuitous. Life goes on. Mother's 90 years old. I've been an enormous influence in my life, the lives of everybody that's in our enormous family. And I noted from Clarence Thomas what he had to say about the importance of family in his life. So if there's some symbolism there, one, it was unintended. But two, I think it might be appropriate. Different backgrounds, but the same sense of strength of family. And I think there's a message not just for Clarence Thomas's family, or our family, but for families all across the country. And as we celebrate Mother's 90th birthday, she's not all that well, but she is our moral leader, was since I was old enough to walk on this marvelous point of land here in Kennebunkport, which was just, you know, from my days in an infant. And everyone in this family, young and old, direct or indirect relations, looks up to her. But I have a feeling that that's still true of a lot of families in this country. Charles, I
wanted to follow on John's question as to whether you might be suggesting that the base closing commission could have gone farther and cut deeper.
No, I didn't intend to say that, because literally I have not gone into the details of the base closing commission.
Could I ask a separate then?
Yeah.
Are you and the Attorney General going to discuss the crime bill as you suggested you ought to?
Yes.
What's your sense of direction on that?
Well, I want to get a good crime bill. We would like to have it all come down together, and everything, options are open here. But we've gotten, in fact, Dick told me now, we had gotten roughly in form. We want four of our five major objectives. The exclusionary rule did not come the way we wanted in the Senate. But I'll defer on more detail on that, because it has to go to a conference, and then we'll see. But I want a comprehensive crime bill. There were some very good things in the Senate bill, and I thank Senator Biden and of course, Senator Thurman and others for that. And I'll just wait and see what comes to my desk. And I urge that it be comprehensive, broad, and then we'll take some things that I like and maybe some things that I don't like, because it is important to get on with a crime bill. But it better come down, I think, in fairness to the American people, in a broad form, not nickel by nickel, dime by dime.
Was he a little premature yesterday in suggesting it was close to acceptable?
Well, I didn't see the story, but as I say, there are many good things in it. But my problem on answering it is I don't know what's going to happen in relation to the House of Representatives out of the conference. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. At the beginning of the, as the war, the Gulf War got closer, you sensed that Saddam Hussein wasn't getting enough information, that our threat was real. There have been reports now, as you were talking about potential military action again. Do you think he's in the dark still?
I don't know on this question, but you're right. I was reminiscing here as I hit Walker's point a couple of days ago that there were two points that I still am convinced of as the pre-battle period went on. One, that he didn't think that we were for real on this. And secondly, that he thought he could prevail, at least enough to have a standoff in the desert and be the hero of certain parts of the world over there. He was wrong on both counts. And if he assumes that he can get away with this kind of thing, he's just as wrong today as he was on August 2nd when he went back into, when he sent his forces into Kuwait.
You don't consider him a very smart man, do you?
I don't consider him a very bright man to have done what he's done. If that's an answer to it, because I can't conceive of why you would directly think you could hide, given the sophistication of technology today, and secondly, why you think you could get away with it. So there's some parallel there. I don't want to overdraw it.
Mr. President, you spoke a bit ago about everyone in the Middle East wanting peace, yet the Israelis seem to have stiff-armed your proposals. The Syrians don't seem to like the terms either. Is there more there than meets the eye?
Probably more than meets the eye, but not as much as I'd like to see meet the eye. I mean, in other words, I think I'd like to see the process further along, but there are a few things that I think offer hope. In fact, in my last communication from President Shamir of Israel was a commitment to try to work for peace. There's some broad commitments, but frankly, I'd like to see us further along on some of the details. And please don't press me on what those details are. But I'm not going to give up hope on this, and I don't think the Secretary is. But we need to have more progress, and we need to have it sooner. I am told that the credibility of the United States for being the catalyst for peace is still very, very strong and very good, not only in Israel, but in the Arab countries as well. So that is an ingredient that wasn't there before. It's still there that I hope will lead to peace.
It's been suggested that the United States might just call a peace conference and see who shows up. Is that an option?
Well, I don't want to go into options, but yes, I've seen suggestions of that nature. And at some point, I think I owe the American people my view of the details I'm not willing to discuss right now. And that wouldn't bother me one bit to get up and say, here's what we've been trying to do. So there's no time frame on anything of that nature. But I think there's a lot of people are wondering what in the world is going on. And I've invoked quiet diplomacy and the need for confidentiality. But I can't do that forever. I just simply can't do it. I owe it to the American people, and I think to people around the world, to say, hey, here's what the United States thinks is a good formula. Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
In reminiscing about the war, can I ask you your comments about your feelings about what's happened in Kuwait since the end of the war, with
yes.
the atrocities there? Your feelings about it? Do you think there's
well, the war
any
wasn't...
reason to believe those democratic forms will take place?
Well, let me say this, and I hope it doesn't come out wrong. The war wasn't fought about democracy in Kuwait. The war was fought about aggression against Kuwait. Having said that, the Kuwaitis have said that they want to move towards the democratic process, and I hope they do, and they should. This would be good. I think one thing that concerned people were the trials. There are different standards for law in all countries, but we want to see fair trials, open trials. A friend of mine in our government, who's quite knowledgeable on history, reminded me of what it was like in France after the liberation of France in World War II. I remember some of it, although I was in the Pacific Theater. And the people that were liberated did not take kindly to those that had sold out to the Nazis. I think we're expecting a little much if we're asking the people in Kuwait to take kindly to those that had spied on their countrymen that were left there, that had brutalized families there, and things of that nature. Having said that, I believe, and I've recommended this to the Kuwaitis, the most open, a fair trial, free justice system is the best. It works best. It gets confidence back in your country. So I can understand the outrage. I'll give you one other example. martial law. We had some problems, you know, why martial law? And it was explained to me, many citizens over there against the law have weapons. Many of them that were in opposition to the Kuwaiti regime. Threatening, using the weapons, showing the weapons when the Iraqis were in power, now keeping the weapons. And they so told me that martial law was essential if they were going to go in and disarm the people that had been helping the enemy. I can understand that. But again, what I'd like to see is as much respect for what we see as legal principles as possible. Yes, Susan, this is the this guy hadn't had one. One, two, and that's it. Unless you appeal. Three?
Back to the G7 for a minute. Are you at all concerned that at all the publicity with Mr. Gorbachev, the plight of the Eastern European countries is not going to get enough attention here? And do you feel any obligation on the part of the Western democracies to guarantee to them the same aid, whatever it is, that Gorbachev walks away with?
You mean Eastern European democracies?
The fact that they have already done the sorts of things that he's only beginning to think about.
I think we got two different questions. But we must not send a signal to Eastern Europe, hey, we're neglecting you, you're on your own, figure it out for yourselves, we're going to turn our attention to Moscow. I don't think it has to be an either-or choice. The Eastern European countries are moving. They need certain kinds of assistance. They're getting some. They're making some progress. They still have problems. But I think your question raises for me a very good point. We don't want to send a signal of neglect or that we think that they should be cut loose to fend for themselves. But there are many things we can do and are doing in Eastern Europe, and that they should not be reduced as we work together to try to figure out how to get the Soviet market, how to get the Soviet economy, how to get the Soviet system moving along the same lines of the Eastern Europeans. This is it's a world problem. It's not a United States problem. You know, it comes up, and I don't want to get too philosophical out here in the sun, but it comes up in another context because people in South America are saying with this major goal of helping reform in the Soviet Union and to some degree in Eastern Europe, are you going to neglect us? And one of the reasons we're having these, I think, very important appearances and a lot of diplomacy going along with it is that we want to reassure the democracies in this hemisphere, which is all but one country from being a totally democratic hemisphere, that we're not going to neglect them. So you raise a good point. We are not going to neglect Eastern Europe, but we are going to work with the others. And everyone knows that we're dealing at this juncture with limited resources. We are in this country. We've got an enormous deficit problem. Other countries have economies that have done worse than ours. And so we've got to be realistic and find ways to help move these people towards market economies, open political systems, is when our advice is sought. And that's what we're trying to do.
So what's the second one? Yeah.
President, thank you. Some weeks ago, you said you were very close to a decision on MFN for the Soviet Union. Have you made that decision? Do you expect to do it before London? Is it tied up in the SALT negotiation?
No, it's not tied up in SALT. It's tied up on a trade agreement. And I think that's the only remaining problem, a trade agreement. And maybe, Bob, come help me on that. When do we think that'll be resolved?
There are a couple of minor technical problems in the trade agreement because of laws that have been passed subsequent to its signature by the Soviet legislature. The technical problems we think are being worked out.
And it's not caught up in the other. Last one.
Yeah.
No, right behind you. Sorry.
It's okay.
Mr. President,
second to last one.
Did you consult anyone else outside of your administration about your Supreme Court nominee? And did I understand you correctly to say that you made your final decision? Was it last night in your living room here or this morning?
Well, it was actually, when I say final, the I was dotted and the T crossed up here just a little bit before lunch. But I had all, just to be very candid about it, all but made my mind up when I invited Judge Thomas up here. As I thought of any hypothetical things that could go wrong, I couldn't think of any. But so much so that I don't think he felt confident enough after our conversation yesterday. I don't think he told his wife, for example, that he was to be the nominee. But And on your first part of your question, no, I stayed with the recommendatory process because many others talk to others. And I must say, if you'll let me off without telling you who I talked to, when this all came up at the time of Judge Souter, I think I did talk to one or two people in confidence that I respect that are outside of this so-called screening process. But I put all the emphasis on this one, on our screening process. And yet I'm confident that as this process is unfolded, Boyd and Gray and our chief of staff and the attorney general and the attorney general's staff have gotten a wide array of views from others. It's better if the president doesn't do this, because if I get out there and talk to somebody, then I think it is much more prone to open discussion and speculation. I don't think that's helpful when you're trying to reach it. This is the last one.
There was some suggestion from a published report that I suspect that you've seen from Jack Kemp that there's not enough attention within his own administration, your administration, on domestic social issues. And I was wondering if you could respond to that.
I didn't read the Kemp story. I've talked to Jack plenty, and he, I think, has referred to this administration and very generously to this president as the empowerment president and one that wants to see a growth in this economy and thus have everybody have a better shot at opportunity. So we're not a part on that. And again, having not understand there was a story in today's paper, I haven't read it, and I probably will. But I don't think we got any differences with Jack Kemp on this. I salute him for what he's done. He takes a good, strong message out to the communities. Home ownership, tenant management. And
but from the article, he suggested the administration has not been as forceful as he has been.
Well, that may be true. He's a real zealot out there, and he's got all the time in the world to do it. That's what his job is about, pushing that envelope, as we say, in the space age forward to include home ownership. And I think if it hadn't been for his zeal, we never would have gotten through the Congress, the House, anything on home ownership or tenant management, and we did. So I give him great credit. So if he's got more zeal on this, I think perhaps, I don't think he feels more strongly in his heart about it, but he is a salesman. He is out there going to places where a lot of Republicans have never been, and I've been at his side a time or two on that. And it's darn good, and I'm proud he is a part of our administration. So if you want me to say something bad about Jack Kemp, no way. Yeah. Last one, really, we got.
A two-hour lunch with Gorbachev make it less urgent to go to Moscow by the end of July?
Not you can't cover everything in 2 hours, but we've got, maybe we'll be able to move the START process forward. I don't know whether we will at a lunch of that nature, but no, it doesn't, in my view, make it less urgent. I want to sit down over a period of time with him to really in-depth discuss issues. It is most important. And a lot of the talk would be philosophical talk, intentions. What do you think our intentions are towards the Soviet Union? I think there's still some misunderstanding in the Soviet military about that, for example. And I'm no Jack Kemp in terms of my salesmanship, perhaps, a little inarticulate and sometimes too prudent. But I think I could convince Gorbachev that their military has nothing to fear from us. So let's take a look. Let's have them do what we're doing in terms of defense spending. I think we can't do it in just a luncheon, but my respect for him is such that I find when we can sit down and talk over a reasonable period of time, you can get into a lot of subjects, which I'm sure we can't do at a two-hour lunch.
Could that still happen by the end of July?
Yes. Yes, it could. Hey, listen, thank you all very much.
No!
Hey, come on, Susan. Thank you all.
Well, finally, after, I believe, three or four absolutely final last questions, President Bush, after about 47 minutes on the stump, in front of his Kennebunkport, Maine vacation home, leaves reporters. He called the news conference at Kennebunkport to announce his intention to fulfill the U.S. Supreme Court seat currently occupied by black Justice Thurgood Marshall with a black man. Let's look briefly at who that is. He is Federal Appeals Court Judge Clarence Thomas. He currently is with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Judge Thomas is 43 years old. He has basically a Catholic education up to the college level. He went to Yale Law School and graduated therefrom. He is also a veteran of the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, served as Missouri State Attorney General, and as an aide to Missouri Republican Senator John Danforth.